Hi, this is Jen, and we are on episode 14 of Minorities in Publishing. If you're just listening, thank you for tuning in. If you're a longtime listener, thank you as well. If I could, I'd bake you all cookies. You can find us on Twitter at Minorities in Pub and on Tumblr, which is our main site, which is minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And I think that covers most of our bases. We have a few episodes also on SoundCloud, and we are on iTunes. So when a new episode goes up, it's immediately pushed onto iTunes. So if you do listen to MIP on iTunes, give us a rating, why don't you? On this episode, I'm really happy to be sitting with Emily XR Pan, who is a fellow writer, editor-in-chief of Bodega Mag, Lit Magazine, and she works for one of the big five in marketing. So thank you so much for your time and being on the podcast today, because you kind of go into each various level of what a writer, like the writer and then the Lit Mags and then the publisher. So it's interesting yeah. You're in various levels of publishing.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Yay! I'm excited for every guest, and I say excited at least a minimum 5 times per episode, as listeners know. So, well, I think we want to start from the beginning, because you went to the NYU MFA program, and you and some of the other editors, the founding editors of Bodega Magazine, met in that program.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you find that particular program in terms of diversity and finding a community, considering that you still work with those you met in the MFA program? And I do keep in contact with a handful of people in my MFA program as well. It seems that you established a very necessary base there.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely found a really great, smart group of friends, people to work with, and I'm grateful to have them as both my colleagues and kind of, you know, the cheerleaders in this really strange pursuit that writing is. It's interesting, though, to talk about the MFA program, because I think it was about a year ago that Juno Diaz wrote that piece, MFA versus POC, in which he talks about how the standard problem of MFA programs is that they're too white. And when that piece came out, I got a lot of emails from friends being like, was this what your experience was?
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, I guess I kind of have to think about it a little bit, but I would say both yes and no. Like, I was really lucky for a lot of reasons to do my MFA at NYU. Like, the student body there is certainly more diverse than in other programs.
The faculty is really
the staff and faculty, yeah. They definitely included writers of color, you know, on the fiction side. My years there, we had Juno Diaz, we had Zadie Smith, we had Colson Whitehead.
All three. Oh my God. Let me have a fangirl moment right there.
And then on the poetry side, there was Kamiko Han, Major Jackson, Yusef Komunyakaa.
Wow.
And I don't think anybody at NYU was actively like, we need to have a diverse group. Who can we hire? You know, I think it's that New York is such a diverse city that you would have to be actively and consciously excluding people of certain demographics in order to come up with a totally homogenous group. So I was really lucky to do my MFA in that kind of an environment where it was organically diverse and our student body like had all the right percentages, you know. But then when we were workshopping, there was kind of this bizarre non-diverse syndrome that people had where like I would submit chapters or stories that drew from my own experiences or like my family's history, and I kept hearing that my writing reminded people of Amy Tan over and over again. People would be like, oh, you really like make me think of Amy Tan's Joyelette Club or The Bonesetter's Daughter. And it started to feel like she was everyone's one reference point for
an Asian American writer.
Yeah, for the Chinese American experience. And it's funny because Amy Tan is not actually someone I would cite as like a huge influence. I don't think I write like her at all.
And she's not, no offense, Amy, super literary. I feel like she straddles that kind of contemporary.
She does kind of straddle it. Yeah, but it was just like her work was probably the one thing that my peers had read that touched the same sorts of topics. Mm-hmm. So then everyone defaulted to it. And that was an interesting experience. And then I, in one class, I workshopped something that was explicitly about racism. And I found myself being told that the story was A, not believable, and B, the story shouldn't be about the racism. And this was like right around the time that Matthew Salas's wrote this piece for The Rumpus called Different Racisms, and it was subtitled On Jeremy Lin and How the Rules of Racism Are Different for Asian Americans. And I really, really connected with that because he talked about how there were these white students reading Don Lee's short stories and they were totally incredulous about the racism. And in response, the professor actually showed an interview in which Don Lee was like, actually, every incident mm-hmm. in the book is something that happened to me personally. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me because the story that I had workshopped was based on my personal experience. I was, you know, trying to tackle a subject and an event that I was still trying to wrap my mind around. And I was being told that that was exactly what the story should not be about. Mm. And so, you know, I think the problem is really the lack of diverse reading habits, that people Absolutely. Aren't reading enough
Absolutely.
Diverse writing. Mm-hmm. These are like smart people that I totally had so much respect for as my peers, but we didn't have the same reference points.
Yeah.
And it was shocking to me, you know, that people would think that, oh, it's racism is no longer a relevant subject to yeah. be focused mm-hmm. upon. And it kind of feels like, you know, anyone in an MFA program is expected to read the same people. Everyone reads Updike, Franzen, Eugenides. Everyone reads David Foster Wallace. I think, like, in my experience, I can literally list the writers I was assigned to read who were people of color. There was Zadie Smith, Juno Diaz, Jamaica Kincaid, and Jhumpa Lahiri. And that was it. Four writers.
Best-selling.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Four writers of color in my MFA experience, in my assigned reading list. So I think that is a really interesting observation to make. I think my experience was probably really different than Juno Diaz's experience in that I had peers who were writers of color. Mm-hmm. But even my peers who were writers of color, we all still used the same reference points, and those reference points were never other authors of color.
Yeah. So did you find once you left the MFA program that for you, even your reading kind of spread out more in terms of reading more diversely?
Yeah, definitely. I think while I was in my MFA program, I was just so grateful to be there and to be working with all these really awesome people mm-hmm. and awesome teachers that I didn't... It was kind of like I wanted to stay in my bubble of everything is wonderful and perfect. Mm-hmm. And like my MFA experience was certainly really, really great. But in hindsight, I can see how it could have been even better. It could have been more eye-opening. Mm-hmm. We certainly could have delved into a more diverse body of work.
Yeah.
And so post-MFA, I've really, really made an effort to try to get my own reading mm-hmm. list to be mm-hmm. more diverse.
Yeah, I think that's something that's just coming up. I mean, also, I'm on the We Need Diverse Books End, another plug for WNDB. And that's our biggest goal, is for people to read more. And I've been seeing it in Bitch Magazine, Bustle, Slate. People are doing these reading lists of, I decided not to read mm-hmm. anyone white this year, or I decided to read only sci-fi by people of color, or I decided just to read transgender books and things like that. So people, it seems to be opening people's eyes, and I completely agree with you that reading diversely is a big step for people to show that they want to read these books, that they want to know, and to be able to better critique someone than having an Indian American in your class and saying, Jhumpa Lahiri, Jhumpa Lahiri, Jhumpa Lahiri, because, you know, you read her because she won the Pulitzer. And she's the only way, you know. So it's,
And surrounding MFA programs, there's all this discussion over how, you know, there are people out there who believe that all MFA programs turn out all the same kind of writing, which I'm not sure I 100% agree with, but maybe, you know, the writing that is very similar is the result of everyone reading all the same work.
And telling you what you can and can't do.
Because
if you're not reading the experimental or the translated works and et cetera, or even different genres, you're not seeing those kind of borders being broken down.
Absolutely.
You can talk in this type of voice. You can structure it differently. You can,
yeah.
And then everyone's trying to be updike, like you said.
Yeah. I definitely had the experience where I was one of very few people who, you know, were reading a ton of other genres aside from the traditional literary canon. You know, I was sitting there kind of hiding my sci-fi novels and my fantasy novels and feeling a little bit embarrassed when I remember on the very first day of my first craft class, the teacher made us go around the room and say what we all loved, and I kind of felt rebellious, and I was like, Lord of the Rings, and
everyone else was really good series, though. It's really good.
And everyone else had been like, oh, you know, Eugenides, Nabokov, and they're like, J.R. Tolkien for the win!
I read one of the books, I've been meaning to, but hello, world building, I'm like, Jesus! I'm with you on the J.R.R. Tolkien, George Martin.
Yeah, George R.R. Martin.
Lainey Taylor, I really like.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with Lainey Taylor.
She's amazing.
That was Daughter of Smoke and Bone was a pretty new discovery for me. I only read all of those books for the first time last year. I mean, I know the third one came out last year, but I devoured them all in a row, and they were. It was the first time in probably over a decade that an entire trilogy had resonated with me so much. You know, like you read a trilogy and sometimes the first book is amazing.
Yeah.
And then the next two books you're like, well, you love them just by virtue of their being in the same trilogy, but you don't have the same feelings about them. This was like every single book I was like, all the feels.
She's such a good writer. And she gets that fantastical world, and then, you know, the literary aspect of her writing and the relationships.
Yeah, her stuff is so great.
The characters, it's
me and the politics.
Oh my gosh. Me and my friends were kind of like, it's out now. We need to go get it. Not now, right now.
I'm like planning when I can reread that trilogy this year. I have to do it.
Anytime.
I feel like I have to plan out my reading list because I read so much for work. And
oh, yeah. And for the magazine, I imagine. Yeah. And anything Octavia Butler.
Yeah.
I got introduced to her last year. And I heard her name for a decade. And I was like, okay, I'll finally get it. And I was like, oh, man. This woman's amazing.
You're like, this is what I've been missing out on all these years.
I was so pissed at myself. And I was like, you know, I could have met her
when
she was alive.
Well, better late than never. Oh,
yeah,
that's true.
She died around the time where everyone's like, Octavia. And I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah. I'm with you on the fantastical and the speculative.
Yeah.
Love it. So for Bodega, getting back to Bodega, I listened to, we were both on the late night conversation with Late Night Library, and the poetry editors for Bodega have
Lizzie
happened to
Amy.
Be on there as well. And they're talking about the structure of Bodega Mag, and I was telling you pre-recording how much I enjoyed the structure of it, especially because it's mainly online. And there's several poems and one prose piece.
One or two.
And it comes out once a month,
Monday. The first Monday of every month.
So it's free, people. It's online. But it's such a good way, I think, as I was telling Emily, to get at a culture that has a shorter attention span. Like, our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, I feel like. Unless you're truly, truly engrossed, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for Lit Mag, especially new literary magazines, to kind of work your way into that world. And I think the structure of Bodega Mag is great. I kind of like how they both mentioned, you know, it's like, you know, you just got to go to the store, get a few things, come back to your apartment, And that's kind of how Bodega Mag is structured. You can see all this. There's a few things for you to absorb.
Yep.
And be able to take away in one sitting.
We call ourselves the literary corner store.
Yeah.
I mean, we pride ourselves exactly on that, on the size. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of Bodega. We publish frequently, but we publish small. You know, we wanted to do something that would really highlight the work that we had curated. Because you think about the usual situation where, especially as a fiction writer, like, you work so hard to polish that story, get it as perfect as possible. You send it off to the Lit Mag, pray it gets accepted, and then they decide to publish you. You're thrilled, but then your six pages, your precious six pages, are swimming in a sea of 300 pages. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what are the chances that everyone who picks up that issue, all of those people, are actually going to read your one piece? Like, mm-hmm. you know, people are picking up that issue to read what their friends have published in it, or mm-hmm. to have, like, a copy of something they've published themselves. And I think there are very few people out there who are actually reading those, like, thick volumes cover mm-hmm. to cover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's just really hard to stand out. It's really hard to make you feel like your work is actually being read. And so we set out to produce an issue that you can read over a lunch break. And because every issue is so small, so focused, all of our writers really feel like their work mm-hmm. is being highlighted.
Yeah. And it's also not weekly, I think, is a really good methodology also of making it truncated, but monthly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, oh, every Friday we have a new piece, which is great to keep featuring emerging writers. But like you mm-hmm. say, you feel like, okay, I get the spotlight for 7 days, maybe 6 days.
Right.
Maybe not.
And then it's someone else's turn.
Yeah. So you get a whole 30 days, 28 in February.
Yeah, and we spend that whole month promoting those pieces on social media, being like, you know, quoting this line from mm-hmm. this beautiful poem, reminding people that this short story is out there, retweeting other people when they mm-hmm. tweet about reading and connecting with something in Bodega. So they get, you know, our contributors get that whole month of spotlight.
Yeah, yeah. So what is the goal with Bodega Mag? I mean, obviously to feature good mm-hmm. writing, but when you do each issue, what goes into that thought process? Is there ever, it seems like they're not necessarily themed, mm-hmm. but it's just really the best that we found, and this works, or these work together in this kind of, talking to poets, the way they think, they have a thematic way they do their chapbooks. And I don't think people realize that with poems.
Right.
That there's actually, you know, a whole reasoning for why this follows this, follows
in
that,
order
section,
to everything.
That, you know. So is that kind of where, you know, the editors come together and say, okay, these poems work together, and this prose kind of fits in with this, and these kind of just have a good, because if someone clicked one by one by one, it could be like a thematic element. It's like, I started off with this really awesome feeling, and now I'm like, wow, this is really deep.
Yeah.
We've gotten deep by the seventh link here.
Well, so our poetry editors have a meeting every month mm-hmm. where they discuss everything they've read, and they choose them. And I know that they tend to have so much content, I think, because poems are so much shorter,
mm-hmm.
Just the nature of them, the way that they're submitted. They have so much content to pick from that I think they are definitely able to focus more on putting together a group of poems that mm-hmm. fits well together.
Mm-hmm.
Our prose side operates a little bit more independently, but it's funny because we notice all these themes that develop kind of unintentionally
mm-hmm.
in issues, and that's always really interesting to see. And I think it's because, you know, sometimes we have work that's very relevant to what's happening right now mm-hmm. in, like, current events, and it's on everyone's mind, so then mm-hmm. it kind of surfaces organically.
Yeah.
Melissa, our prose editor, was just reminding me how, I think it was our 22nd issue, where we coincidentally just had an all-women issue, which I think is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Like, literally, we didn't set out to have an all-women issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we publish a lot of women. I think Was it last year when we were inspired by Vita?
Oh, yeah, the Vita account.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We like tallied up and we had published exactly half and half of women
fantastic.
And men, which was, and not at all intentionally, because we don't have any kind of a quota for mm-hmm. anything. Mm-hmm. We don't say like, oh, we need more diversity, we need more women. We just pick the absolute best content, and amazingly, everything happens to follow organically that mm-hmm. we have a diverse group of writers. We publish a lot of women, and it's just a matter of us picking what's fresh and relevant and beautifully done. So I really take pride in that model, because I feel like that's the ideal model for any kind of art being published, to just pick what's good without any kind of bias, without like setting out to choose anything, without taking it into account race or gender or location or age or any of that. And I think a huge part of it is that, you know, we're like a nonprofit on the internet. We have the freedom to do this. Mm-hmm. We can be innovative and progressive versus mm-hmm. huge publishing houses who are super traditionalist and worrying about what's expected to sell and mm-hmm. what might be pigeonholed and how to break the mold.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we're very lucky.
Yeah, that freedom of also being online.
Yeah.
To do that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really enjoyed it. It's a cool, like you said, it's a good lunch break.
Yeah.
Read. So I've been steadily making my way through 3 years. So I'll get there. I will definitely get there. So from the writing side, as a writer, what do you find is your focus in terms of what your work is about? You recently had a story published in Joyland Magazine. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
And it has elements of the fantastical, but digs into someone feeling like they're unable to love. And this is not a story about being a minority. Like you mentioned, you know, like you had that one story. It's like, this is about race.
Yeah.
And this story was really kind of working on the universal theme that I think is in every story, mm-hmm. love. I think it's in, no matter what the story is about, love is at the center of all of them. I mm-hmm. think people will more than likely disagree with me. So you had a very large subject matter that's relatable to everyone. Do you find that there's ever been an expectation to write culturally or strictly of your background, or a need to color code your characters?
Well, so in terms of my focus, everything I write is kind of unintentionally about identity, mm-hmm. and you know, sometimes I'm writing about my specific experiences as an Asian American woman, sometimes it's me trying to capture a slice of my family's history, mm-hmm. Sometimes it's wacky or fantastical, trying to come at, you know, the same questions of placement within the world but from a totally different angle, which is what that Joyland mm-hmm. piece was. And I've never felt like people wanted me to only be writing about my Chinese American experiences. Mm-hmm. Like, I've definitely had friends who said that, in workshop, for example, they were asked why they weren't writing about a cultural experience. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a weird question to get. But I actually have sometimes felt the opposite. Like, sometimes people have reacted better if, I, you know, had a story that left out descriptions of how characters looked. Mm. And I don't have enough data to say for certain, but I have had remarks from people where they said that they liked my stories better when I didn't include moments of racism. And maybe it's that like the moments of racism weren't written effectively, but also maybe it's that my peers or whoever reading just didn't want to be reminded that racism is still a big problem.
They wanted to feel good.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. And I don't want people to feel good when I write stories like that.
The Joyland story is a very good story, but it's not a feel-good, warm, fuzzy, everything's wonderful story. And you lead up to that, because mm-hmm. it's there's the tone in the beginning, and you're just like, oh, man. Oh, man. oh, what's the inciting incident? What's like, where is this going? And then it really hits a nerve, I think, effectively.
Oh, thank you.
And that's what I think the point of writing is.
Yeah.
Is to hit that nerve for anyone to be able to relate to that. So it's interesting to me that you say that potentially stories have worked better in that instance because it's a sad story.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. So I'm like, how can that make you feel better? Like, because there's not like racially ambiguous, you know.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
The social context is like, I can deal with someone having a broken heart.
Right.
Or, you know, I can deal with mass murderers, but I can't deal with you telling me that racism is happening in 2015.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like the color coding question you asked before is interesting because like I used to experiment a lot with leaving out descriptions of eye and skin color and cultural specifics, especially if my pieces had a fantastical focus, kind of like that Joyland piece. And I might see a character in my head as being Black or Korean or Latino, and I would maybe include names to kind of match or habits to subtly reflect that, but I wouldn't necessarily call it out. It would just be in there because I mostly write about American characters. Yeah. In my brain, everyone is American.
Yeah.
But like, for example, in that Joyland piece, you know, my main character is named Eugene. Mm-hmm. And in my brain, I had kind of imagined him to like maybe be half Korean.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't something I explicitly said at all.
Yeah.
And in the past, I kind of felt like that was my way of trying to navigate the like melting pot of the U.S. in my work. But then recently it started to feel more important than ever that I explicitly identify a person of color. Because if I don't, readers automatically assume that they're white.
Absolutely.
And that's something that is like really, really sad, actually, that, you know, I do it too. I'm a person of color, and
I do it
too.
You've been conditioned to do it.
Exactly.
I do it as well, and it's trying to work this mentality of this is the default.
Yeah.
When technically, you know, minorities are the default.
Yeah.
We're a large population, and a lot of us were born here.
Oh, yeah.
Just to emphasize that.
And it's especially important to me that I make it clear now because I've started writing for younger and younger audiences, and I think back on my middle school and high school self reading fantasy novels full of mages and elves, but very, very few people of color, and definitely never, ever main characters of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that kind of leads into another question, which is the discussion that I've had with Danielle and Sona on an earlier episode about the lack of mirrors and seeing others like yourself in an industry like publishing that considers itself pretty liberal. I've been in publishing for going on 13 years. And we don't see that necessarily in the book side. And I found I don't see it necessarily on the business side as well. But as someone on the marketing end, do you see discussion happening that may or may not always consider the wide range of audiences for a book or see what the potential is for gaining a wider audience?
Well, so I'm in trade marketing, and our goal in trade marketing is actually to always hit as wide an audience as possible, regardless of the content, regardless of who wrote the book. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be pretty encouraging as a writer of color, seeing the way the pieces move inside a house. You know, our marketing plans don't change in size based on whether an author is a man or a woman or whether it's a writer of color. I feel like when it comes to a book reaching a wider audience, there's a lot of filtering that actually happens at the level that directly touches the consumer. Like at BookCon last year, at the We Need Diverse Books panel, Grace Lynn talked about how she went to visit that library where there was that librarian who hadn't expected her work to resonate at all with any of the kids just because of their demographic, just because it wasn't like the stories they were used to. And that's clearly one of the biggest struggles, getting booksellers and librarians to, you know, be on board, especially those in the parts of the country that are super homogenous, to get them to be open-minded about books that are not homogenous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've gotten word from booksellers on the WNDB side saying, well, they've been very emphatic about trying to sell, but I did hear stories from booksellers saying, well, you know, I had to turn the cover over because it had a person of color on it, and the parent didn't seem to want that book for their child because they didn't think they'd identify with it. So they had to hide the cover, which is very disappointing to hear that the consumer mindset, you know, it's kind of this systematic thing that kind of just trickles down and just like, well, I don't think my kids will like that. And then talking to authors who say, I talk to kids everywhere. Jean Neri spoke to a couple weeks ago. He said, I have kids in Germany who love my books, and he's African American. Yeah. He's writing about African American cowboys, and there are kids in Germany who love his books.
Yeah.
So there is that assumption, and it is interesting that there are just so many levels where it can be kind of blocked.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I feel like there are definitely pockets around the world, around this country, where there are people who just can't get over this idea that, you know, it's valuable to read a book about someone who doesn't look like yourself, who doesn't identify the same way you do. But then there are also so many kids out there who are thrilled to read those books, and the problem is that people aren't realizing that that's so valuable, that that's actually a bigger population than they think.
Yeah, yeah. And then you don't want people, those kids, to grow up to be in the MFA program saying racism doesn't exist. Just saying.
Yeah.
So for you, when did publishing become the pursuit in terms of your career? Did you hear about this early? Were you a teenager who was in love with books and knew that publishing was a career option? Or was that something you found out in undergrad and MFA? I'm curious, because there seems to be a consistent answer from guests thus far.
Oh, working interesting. In publishing. Well, I had thought about it, I think, probably starting in high school.
Really?
And I actually, because I'd always been this like nerdy storyteller who was writing all sorts of things. So then it kind of naturally followed that when I figured out that there were these companies that made books, that maybe one day I might consider being an editor, or maybe I would one day want to do some kind of job that like brought me closer to these books that I was hoarding in my bedroom.
So how did you find out that that was an industry you could get into?
I think that I didn't really think about it seriously for a very long time. And in college, I was like hunting for internships, and I remember noticing that Penguin offered internships in a wide variety of fields.
Yeah, the rotational program, wasn't it? Or maybe that's another
question. I don't know. I think there are, I think a couple houses do offer a rotational program.
Yeah.
But I remember, so for college, I went to a business school. I went to NYU Stern. And I was specifically looking for marketing internships. Mm. And that was when I first was like, oh, there's a whole side to publishing that isn't just making words and putting together covers and printing things. There's a whole side that's like, you know, the people who actually make the world know about those books.
Yeah.
And that really intrigued me. But it was something that didn't seem practical, because we're I was in business school, there was kind of this high pressure to get a certain type of job. Like, all my friends were trying to get jobs at investment banks or accounting firms or ad agencies.
Big money jobs.
Yeah. I mean, not that, I don't think an ad agency is really big money, but
I don't know.
But investment banks certainly are. And there was definitely that pressure to follow suit. And so I kind of like dumped the idea of publishing in the back of the closet, like, it didn't seem practical. It didn't seem like something I could ever really pursue. And then it wasn't until I finished my MFA that, you know, I quit my original career to do my MFA.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was it business related?
Or? Yeah. I was working for a startup, and I was really, really not happy there.
Okay.
It was a terrible, terrible match for me.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people probably feel the same way coming out of business school. You try to land this job that you think your business degree is worth,
mm-hmm.
and then you're miserable and you don't know what to do about it. And I was really lucky in that I had an out because I had spontaneously decided to apply to these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky to get in, and so I quit my job, and at the end of my MFA program, I decided that I wanted to try something totally new, and it seemed like the best time to try to get into publishing, because I mm-hmm. had just finished a degree that was all about writing. Like, yeah. when was it ever mm-hmm. going to be more relevant mm-hmm. for me? So that was the point at which I started actually applying to jobs.
Okay.
Like
jobs, not doing internships or anything.
Right. I think I'm a little bit of an anomaly in the publishing world. I never did a publishing internship.
Wow.
And I had to apply to several jobs before I was considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the lack of an internship probably was a huge reason for that.
Interesting. Yeah, because a lot of previous guests have said internships.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they were so lucky to have, Anjali Singh has said that, you know, someone knew her parents or her brother and they said, hey, your sister likes to read a lot, right? Well, I work in a publishing house and maybe she'll want to do that. And she said, what? You can work and do all this stuff with books? And even I didn't even consider it until
yeah.
undergrad, and someone said, hey, we have a publishing program. And I said, what? This is amazing. Because I don't want to teach kids at all. So it's pretty consistent that people don't see it as a career until college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that there's some kind of outreach that publishing could do to younger people to actually make it? I mean, maybe it's being done now. I feel like with social media,
yeah,
people know. It's like, wow, you can do these things. Your job can be tweeting about books. And
yeah.
You can have Facebook and marketing, editorial, da 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 da. But do you feel like when you were learning about it, that someone could have, like, there was some way that you could have learned about this as a viable job option in some way? Or
I mean, I feel like things are probably super different now because everybody turns to the internet for everything.
Yeah.
But I do wish that, like, I do wish that I had gotten advice about pursuing a job that was interesting to me and not a job that paid well, because I would have started in publishing so much earlier, I
mm-hmm,
think.
Mm-hmm. And you might have been able to have the capacity to do the internships without worrying
yeah.
about...
And I think it's amazing that, like, one of the things that We Need Diverse Books is going to do is offer those, like, are they, like, grants or scholarships or something to,
mm-hmm.
to people of color who are doing...
Yeah, to actually be paid for internships.
Yeah, that's yeah. really amazing because, you know, in publishing, internships don't pay that well.
Or they don't.
Or at all.
You might
yeah.
get pizza for lunch once a week.
Yeah. Some houses don't pay at all, which
yeah.
is really difficult. But that's an amazing initiative. I think that it is really challenging that publishing is so low paying, you
mm-hmm.
know, because coming from a minority background, it's really common for people to not have the means. They're from families that are used to not having the means, and they feel the pressure to
yeah.
get a much higher paying
mm-hmm.
job, and that can feel like a barrier to entry. That
Absolutely.
Like, why bother getting a job that's going to pay you so little? But I feel like the happiness that you derive from it is so huge.
Yeah.
It's worth the few years it takes to, like, get a reasonable salary.
Yeah. I mean, I never went my mom urged me to go into business.
Yeah.
And I never did. So I'd just been in publishing and jumped around a bit till I found my fit. But it's definitely something where it's like you need to find your fit. And if
yeah.
you were miserable at
yeah.
that place, then you needed to leave.
Yeah.
You couldn't
oh, absolutely.
Stay. Yeah.
My parents were, like, urging me to leave. It was one
oh,
of those.
Oh, okay.
It was one of those places where I think they were really thrilled. I was one of those, like, strangely fortunate people who, in the recession, I had 3 job offers out of school, which
wow.
is, like, I was super lucky. I don't know how it happened. It's
yeah.
just dumb luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked the job that was the highest paying, but I had the least interest in. But it's
mm-hmm.
one of those things where I felt that pressure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
When you come out of NYU Stern, they survey you to see what your starting salary is. And it's
oh
like a,
gosh.
It's like this whole point of pride for the school that I think before the recession, they had like a 98% job placement ratio. When recruiters came to the campus. It was this huge, huge deal where everybody was like, oh my God, on-campus recruitment is happening. Did you get an interview with so-and-so? And it's this really crazy culture that it's so easy to get caught up in and then forget that, oh, right, you should, like, try to be happy.
It's like, I want to eat and be happy. Yeah, is this possible? And pay rent in New York City.
Yeah.
So also, in reading some of your very reflective blog posts, I like the whole yoga writing. I noticed similarities between us. You're working on a book of your heart. That's what you phrased it as. That has been
I stole the phrase from Nova Rensuma.
Oh, she's darling. Such a sweetheart. And that this has been an idea for you for several years and is starting to take shape. And I've also written a book, and that's we're in year 8. I call it my child. It was a toddler. It was a baby. It's a toddler. Now it's a child. So as a writer, especially when tapping into a story that is part of your family line, how much do you feel a pressure to get the representation right of a world that you may not wholly know that they went through? And the past for our family was different, and at times similar world, but the discourse and instances of being a minority, being a woman, being a young person in the past, or an older person in the present, it can be hard to tackle. So how do you find yourself moving forward on this project with that understanding of tapping into aspects of culture from a different perspective? That's a long So thank you for humoring me with that long passage.
Well, so the project that you're talking about is a story that I actually came up for the idea for it in 2008, and I started drafting it in 2010, speaking of time. And over all these years, you know, I've rewritten significant chunks of it several different ways, changing the premise, changing the voice. And now I've finally settled into something that seems to actually be working. But the reason it took all that time and all those multiple drafts and experiments was me struggling to figure out which way to focus the lens. And I think it's exactly like what you're saying, this pressure to get the representation of the world right. That pressure was crippling for me in the beginning. You know, one really important facet of the story that I'm working on, it's based on these crazy things that happened to my grandmother in Taiwan in the 1930s. And I like drowned myself in research trying to capture that old Taiwan. My grandmother was living up in these mountains that have really changed now. The terrain is all different. The mountains don't even have the same names anymore. There are no photographs or records, really. And I sent my mom on a visit because she was visiting family. So I was like, you have to go and like visit these mountains. You have to take pictures. You have to take video. And she did, but she was like, you know, I went with your grandmother and she said that this is nothing alike. It's not even a reference point anymore. You know, my grandmother was born in 1927, I believe, and that's almost 90 years ago for this landscape and this place to have totally changed. The culture's not even the same anymore. And so I really struggled to figure out. I was like, I'm trying to write this historical fiction novel and I can't even really visualize the place, and I'm inventing so much stuff, but then I'm like, what's historically accurate? And I realized that instead of it being historical fiction, I had to make it relevant to myself. So I had to give it a new context. And I ended up making the grandmother the same age as my grandmother. And instead of having her be the main character, my protagonist was this teenage girl who was meeting her grandmother for the first time and learning all these things about her own heritage. So I had this like modern American girl exploring this Taiwanese Chinese history. And now that's given me a really interesting frame in which to explore identity and differences in culture. And it's working so much better, but it definitely is taking so much time and so much thought, because it's not as straightforward as I thought it was when I was like, oh, I'm gonna write a historical fiction thing.
Yeah, you know, why not?
I just like sit down, do the research, write some note cards, right? Isn't that how you write a novel? Just like comes together, right? So, yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
And Jackie Woodson had said that it's so important to get these stories down, to get our elders' stories, to talk to them, to hear from them, to learn from them.
Yeah.
So do you feel like that's also a responsibility? Is like we need to tell these stories before those voices go away? And also for us being minorities, of telling these alternate stories. Mm-hmm. And so that you're not pigeonholed as like Amy Tan.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, like guaranteed someone would say that reminds me of Joy Luck Club simply because it's historical.
Yeah.
And it has the matriarch.
Yeah.
But yours is telling a different aspect of the connection or reconnection, you know, and looking at old versus new, how landscapes change and understanding things like that too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm excited about your project.
Thank you.
I'm glad it's coming together.
Oh, thanks.
It just takes a few years.
Oh, yes. Who knows when I'll be done with it.
Yeah, I think that's around the time I started mine as well. 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
So like, man, it's 2015. So we're going back to mirrors. The idea of mirrors is very prevalent in the ongoing discussion on diversity. And in the most recent Asian American Literature Roundtable posted on The Toast, I think it was a couple weeks ago as of this taping, it was noted by the participants that of the limited books by about Asian American characters, that they could not always relate to them. And one book that came up frequently was Joy Luck Club, Amy Tan. And how could a teenage girl necessarily relate to that book when what you may be dealing with in the 1990s and 2000s is very, very different? And this kind of coincides with what you're working on, is looking at a teenage girl's mindset.
Yeah.
Did you find, as a younger reader and perhaps also in college, which you kind of touched upon in your MFA program, that books you read didn't seem to have a range of diverse voices that reflect the things you could relate to? And I'm talking about the stuff that was published.
Yeah.
Too. Like, I know for me, whenever anyone asks what I read as a kid and a teen, Babysitter's Club, Sweet Valley High, R.L. Stein. Not very diverse. Babysitter's Club a little bit, but those three, no. So.
Yeah, Babysitter's Club had, what's her name, Claudia?
Right? Had Claudia, yeah, which was awesome. The token Asian. Oh my gosh, I was just like, that was really my first introduction to an Asian American in books. Yeah,
I remember thinking she was nothing like me, though.
Yeah, she was pretty well off, no? She was fashionable. I remember she was the fashion-conscious one.
She was fashionable, and wasn't she the one who had, like, all these snacks in her room all the time? And
was that her, or was that Stacy?
Oh, I forget. Don't know.
It's
oh my god, it's been a while.
It's losing. I'm losing. But Jesse, who came later, was the sole black character, and she was very athletic. Not athletic over here. Not a book nerd. So yeah. I couldn't really relate to Jesse. I was just happy to see Jesse and Claudia, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, what did I read growing up? I had this, probably you would say, unhealthy obsession with Holocaust books.
Wow.
That's the point.
Heavy.
For probably 3 years, that was all that I read. Wow. And then my sixth grade teacher, she had us doing regular book reports, and every single book I did was a Holocaust book. And these weren't just novels. Like, a lot of them were nonfiction accounts. And she, at one point, was like, maybe you should read something different. She was like, here's Harry Potter. That was my introduction to Harry Potter. But I had also really gotten into fantasy before that through the Prydain Chronicles, you know, the Book of Three, etc.
And fantasy doesn't technically, or mass market fantasy these days, isn't very diverse.
It's not. And I definitely, I was totally baffled by the lack of people of color, you know. I was one of those geeks who collected cloaks. I had my boot knives.
Oh,
I had
my swords.
I would like dress up and stand out in my backyard among all the trees and make my mom take pictures of me like I was some woodland elf. And, you know, it really bothered me. It still bothers me that for the simple fact that I am Asian, I don't look like someone who belongs in the fantasy novels that I love so much. You know, like, if I went to a convention or, you know, a midnight book release, I was that token Asian in the cloak with the sword.
The elf, quote
unquote. Yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, when I dressed up for Harry Potter events, people were automatically like, oh, you're Cho Chang, right? And I'd be like, no, I'm some other Ravenclaw, okay? I'm not Cho Chang. but I definitely felt like a lack of characters that reflected me. Like, you know, I never found any stories that were about being Chinese American. Families that I read about in books were never anything like mine. There was just, it, I got to a point where I started to assume that nobody was ever going to write anything like that.
Wow. So is that part of the impetus for you writing that?
Probably, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I mentioned before, everything I write kind of accidentally, unintentionally ends up being about identity. And I think a lot of it is, you know, growing up, I really prided myself on being Chinese. I was born in Illinois, so I'm totally American, but I really clung to the values that my parents taught me. I really, really loved all the traditions and customs that they preserved in within our household, and I thought of myself as super Chinese. And then in college, I went and studied abroad in China, in Shanghai, for a year, and I became friends with all these Chinese people, and I realized I wasn't Chinese. Like,
American.
I was American, but then I was like, actually, you know, being Chinese American is a very specific group. There's a whole culture to it, you know, and, that people don't really think about or explore. Now people are with shows like Fresh Off the Boat. Now it's like started to become a thing, and there are comedians out there who all they're Asian American and they're trying to, you know, bridge the gap and also make people more aware of this very specific little culture that is Asian American, where you're not 100% American because you have the context of a family that has all these other different values that are totally different than anything, you know, your fellow classmates who are not people of color are used to. But then you also don't have the same values as people who were born and raised over in Asia at all. You know, like, you see things totally differently. Your humor is totally different. Sarcasm is totally different. It was really interesting. It took me 6 months to experience culture shock. I was there in China for 6 months when suddenly it hit me. I was like, I am not Chinese.
But as soon as you come back home, you are.
So
Aziz Ansari talks about that too, because he was born in South Carolina. He's like, I am Indian American. I am American, though. I'm from South Carolina. People, it's similar. Because I've said this before, that I feel like race in America is very black and white, and that anyone who doesn't fit those two is not necessarily, it's not understood or comprehensible to some that you are American.
Yeah.
Like, you are American. And that people will assume that you're always from someplace else.
Yeah.
Even though you're like, no, I'm from Illinois, I'm from South Carolina, I'm from Jersey. But it's like, no. But you have to be from someplace else, right? Because they don't know, I don't think the history is understood of how there's a great migration of every different culture.
Yeah.
You know, like Asian Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, there were migrations.
Yeah.
They're full on migrations. So it shouldn't be seen as, oh, they're currently migrations. It's like, yeah, people are coming over, but a good bulk of people came here 50 to 60 years ago and beyond. So.
And there are people of color who don't get that either. Like,
that's crazy to me.
I tweeted about this a few weeks ago, but I was sitting at lunch in a cafe a few weeks ago, and this guy interrupted my lunch to be like, excuse me, I was just wondering, what's your nationality? Totally out of the blue, just interrupted my lunch to ask this. And I was like, I'm American. And he was like, but, like, where are you from originally? And I was like, American.
Oh my God, that's the question.
And he's like, American and what else? And I was like, American. I am American. That is my nationality. I was born in Illinois.
That's on my passport.
Yeah. And then he was like, oh, I thought maybe you were Japanese or something. And I kind of wanted to be like, you have dark skin. Should I assume you're from Ghana? Should I assume you're from Namibia? Like, we're all American.
Yeah.
I hear you talk. You're American. You hear me talk. I'm American. Like, it's shocking to me.
Yeah. And it's that question. Because consistently.
It's always that question. Where are you from really originally? From.
Yeah. Yeah. And you say, Illinois.
Yeah.
Hello. Or just say, are you know... Oh, God. I don't know. There's no good way to phrase it. Yeah. There's just no good way to phrase it. Like, are you from New York? Maybe that. Like,
yeah.
You're from New York and you say, no, I'm from Illinois. Boom. Done.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So thank you, Emily, so much. This has been such a great conversation.
Yeah, I really thank appreciate you for having me.
So, Bodega Mag, what can you tell us about?
Oh, Bodega. Yeah. Check out Bodega Mag.
BodegaMag.com.
Yep. We will be at AWP next month. There's my plug. Come visit us. We'll be at table 222.
And AWP is from April 8th to the 11th.
Yes.
So
in Minneapolis, where it will probably be very cold.
I hope not. I really hope not for everybody going.
I'm so tired of this winter. I just need some sun.
Yeah.
Today was pleasant. Please, Minneapolis, give us some sun.
I really hope. All these literary types, there's going to be a lot of readings and drinking. Give them sun. They're going to be in conference halls all day. Give them sun.
Yeah.
Since 60 degrees. So Bodega Mag will be at AWP.
And read and submit to us.
Yeah. And you're open for submissions, what, year-round?
Yep. It? Always rolling submissions.
Oh, fantastic.
We're now on Submittable, so it's super convenient to send something in.
It must be for you, too.
Yeah.
And thank you again, and good luck with the book of your heart.
Thank you so much.
I look forward to reading it, because you're going to finish.
I am.
I know you're going
to
finish.
One day I will. And I look forward to reading your child.
Yeah. It'll be in college by then. So we will be back in April. I'm going to be on a bit of a hiatus because I am going on a much needed vacation.
Oh, lucky.
Overseas, Italy.
Amazing.
Risotto is happening. Risotto and gelato. So if you see that Minorities in Pub is a little quiet on social media, we'll be popping up. There'll be scheduled posts and whatnot of previous episodes. But if you notice a little quiet, didn't disappear, just went on vacation. And I will be back in April. So thank you again, Emily.
Thank you.
And see y'all soon.